Hi, I'm Daniel Lipkins.
And this is Mick, the Doctor of Digital.
And welcome to Music 101. Music 101 is created to empower music itself, and let me tell you, I can end the music industry. Another week, another great episode, The Symphony of the Screen, the world's greatest movie soundtrack, and how film scores shape the architecture of human emotion, part one.
So what makes a movie soundtrack unforgettable? Is it the way a song can transport us back to a specific scene, a specific moment in our lives when we first heard it? Or is it the commercial power of music married to cinema, the ability to sell millions of albums and dominate charts for months on end? The story of movie soundtracks is really the story of two art forms harmonizing to create something greater than either could achieve alone. From the earliest days of Hollywood musicals to our current era of algorithmic playlists and streaming revival, movie soundtracks have shaped popular culture in ways not always anticipated by their creators. In conclusion, it's a story of technological disruption, corporate synergy, brilliant creative accidents, and the eternal human desire to hear the perfect song at the perfect cinematic moment.
A perfect song indeed. So, Mr. Mick, when we think about movie soundtracks today, we immediately think of albums, physical products you could buy and take home. But movies have been using music since the very beginning. How did Hollywood's Golden Age approach the relationship between the film and music? And what were some of the earliest examples of songs that become hits because of movies?
And that's such an important question because it gets at something fundamental about how we consume music from films. You're absolutely right that the soundtrack album, as we know it, didn't exist in the early days of cinema. In fact, during the silent film era, music was performed live in theaters. Pianists, organists, or even full orchestras would play along with the film using sheet music that was sometimes distributed with the movie prints. But everything changed in 1927 with The Jazz Singer, which featured synchronized sound and forever altered both the film and music industries. The 1930s to the 1950s represent what many historians call the golden age of Hollywood musicals, and this era produced some of the most enduring songs in American popular culture. People would go to see The Wizard of Oz in 1939. Fall in love with Judy Garland singing Over the Rainbow, and then go home to play it on their own pianos using purchased sheet music. The song won the Academy Award for Best Original Song in 1940. But here's the fascinating part. MGM studio executives nearly cut it from the film because they thought it slowed down the pacing and was too sophisticated for a children's movie. The American Film Institute later named it the greatest song in film history. The 1940s brought us another monumental movie song, White Christmas, from the 1942 film, Holiday Inn. Bing Crosby's recording became the best-selling single of all time, with estimated sales exceeding 50 million copies worldwide. Think about that for a moment. This was before the LP record format, before rock and roll, before the entire modern music industry as we know it. The 1950s brought technological change that would reshape movie music forever. The introduction of the long-playing vinyl record in 1948. Suddenly, you could have an entire musical's worth of songs on one disc. That's when we start to see the emergence of the original soundtrack album as a commercial product. Movies like Singin' in the Rain, 1952, could sell albums featuring Gene Kelly performing Singin' in the Rain, and Donald O'Connor's spectacular Make 'em Laugh. In fact, the whole movie is a treasure. But here's what's really interesting about this era. The songs often outlived the films in popular consciousness. Henry Mancini's Moon River from Breakfast at Tiffany, 1961. The song won the Oscar for Best Original Song and became a standard that Andy Williams would perform for decades. The song's commercial life extended far beyond the movie itself. It hit number 11 on the Billboard Hot 100 in a version by Andy Williams. Similarly, As Time Goes By from Casablanca, 1942, the song became synonymous with romance itself. Even though written for the film, it was a song from 1931 that was repurposed. Dooley Wilson's performance in the film is so memorable that many people assume he recorded the popular version, but he didn't. Rudy Valli had the hit recording. What made the era special was the integration of music into storytelling. These weren't songs slapped onto the end credits. They were organic parts of the narrative. When Gene Kelly performs Singin' in the Rain, the song is the scene. They're inseparable. Hollywood's golden age established a template for movie songs that would endure for generations. Memorable melodies, lyrics that captured universal emotions, and performances so iconic that the song and the visual image became forever linked in the public imagination. In conclusion, this era proved that movies could be powerful vehicles for launching songs into the cultural stratosphere, even before the modern soundtrack album existed as a commercial format.
The 1960s seems to represent transition period, Mr. Meek. We're moving away from the classic Hollywood studio system, but we also get 60s rock and roll and rock. What's happening during this decade that made it so significant for movie music?
Yes, the 1960s were significant, but I'll mention an earlier film in which the song in it made it memorable during the transition. Rock Around the Clock, featuring in the iconic film Blackboard Jungle, 1955, is more than just a catchy tune. It's a cultural milestone that ignited the rock and roll revolution. The electrifying song, performed by Bill Haley and his Comets over the opening credits, forever associates the rebellious spirit of youth and the emerging energy of rock and roll. The song is a powerful anthem that not only introduces and energizes the narrative, but also marks a pivotal moment in music history. Embracing this song means embracing change, excitement, and the unstoppable force of rock and roll. The 1960s represent this fascinating inflection point in movie soundtrack history because you have old Hollywood making its last grand statement with epic roadshow musicals, while simultaneously new forces in popular music, particularly rock and roll and the British invasion, were completely transforming what young audiences wanted to hear. It's a decade of tremendous tension between these two worlds and produced some of the most commercially successful soundtrack albums ever made, even as the cultural ground was shifting beneath everyone's feet. Elvis Presley, hailed as the king of rock and roll, was much more than a musical icon. He also was a significant figure in the world of cinema. Elvis's roles in movies were pivotal in shaping popular culture and redefining the potential of celebrity stardom. Elvis's entrance into Hollywood came at a time when youth culture was burgeoning and the entertainment industry was evolving rapidly. His films, starting with Love Me Tender, 1956, captured the charisma that made him a sensation on stage. Movies like Jailhouse Rock, 1957, and King Creole, 1958, highlighted Elvis's dynamic presence and natural acting ability, blending narrative storytelling with electrifying musical performances. And with Elvis's career expanding into the charming Southern Gentleman in Blue Hawaii, 1961, demonstrating versatility that complemented his musical persona. The blend of music, dance, and drama in his 1960s movies created a template for future musical films and biopics, influencing countless artists who sought to merge multiple disciplines into their craft. Elvis's success in movies redefined what it meant to be a celebrity. Unlike traditional movie stars who rose through acting alone, Elvis leveraged his pre-existing fame as a musician to carve out a unique space in Hollywood. His films were often built around his musical performances, creating a hybrid genre that blurred lines between concert, musical, and narrative film. Elvis Presley's contributions to cinema were far more than mere footnotes in his legendary career. His movies played an essential role in shaping popular culture by integrating rock and roll into mainstream entertainment, showcasing his artistic range and reinventing the concept of celebrity. After Elvis, there was no smooth one-way direction towards rock and movies. Let's start with the elephant in the room, Sound of Music, 1965. The film's soundtrack is one of the best-selling albums of all time, with estimates suggesting it sold over 20 million copies in the first few years alone. The album spent 109 weeks in the top 10 of the Billboard 200 and held the number one position for 16 weeks. These are staggering numbers that few contemporary artists would dream of achieving. There are several key songs like My Favorite Things, Do Re Mi, and Edelweiss. The Sound of Music succeeded despite being completely out of step with contemporary pop music. When it was released in 1965, the Beatles had already appeared on Ed Sullivan, Bob Dylan had gone electric, and the Rolling Stones were charting. The musical's Rodgers and Hammerstein songs represented a style of songwriting that was, in many ways, already nostalgic. This tells us something important about the 1960s. There were actually two distinct music markets operating simultaneously. The youth market was driving the pop charts, and the family adult market was still wanted safe, wholesome entertainment of traditional musicals. The same dynamic played out with Mary Poppins, 1964, another Disney musical extravaganza. The Sherman Brothers wrote songs like Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious and A Spoonful of Sugar, as well as Chin Chin Cherie, which won the Oscar for Best Original Song. The soundtrack album reached number one on the Billboard 200 and stayed on the charts for 14 weeks. Again, this is happening while the Beatles are releasing A Hard Day's Night and Beatles for Sale, completely different musical universes coexisting in the marketplace. The Beatles are universally celebrated as one of the most influential bands in the history of music, but their impact extends far beyond their albums and concerts. Their movies, such as A Hard Day's Night and Help and Yellow Submarine, showcase their music in a unique cinematic way that has captivated audiences for decades. The Beatles movies utilize their songs as a crucial narrative elements rather than mere background music. In A Hard Day's Night, the film opens and closes with the iconic title track, immediately immersing viewers into the hectic yet humorous life of the band. The songs of the Beatles in these movies are not only entertaining, but also essential to storytelling, mood setting, and cultural influence. Songs in these films correspond with specific scenes that reflect the characters' emotions and actions. For example, Can't Buy Me Love accompanies scenes filled with youthful exuberance and romantic pursuit, linking the music directly to the storyline. The method of storytelling through song was innovative at the time and set a precedent for musical films that followed. The Beatles songs do more than tell a story. They create an atmosphere that defines each movie's tone. In Help, the soundtrack ranges from upbeat rockers like Ticket to Ride to more whimsical tunes such as You're Going to Lose That Girl, striking a balance between adventure and comedy. The playful yet suspenseful mood created by the music complements the film's blend of action and humor. Meanwhile, Yellow Submarine uses psychedelic and experimental tracks like Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds to craft a surreal, colorful world that's both imaginative and emotionally resonant. The emotional power of the Beatles songs in their films enhances viewers' connections to the band and their stories. The Beatles' seamless blending of music and film paved the way for future artists to explore multimedia storytelling. The Beatles songs in their movies are far more than catchy tunes. They are vital components that drive narrative, establish mood, and forge emotional bonds with audiences. The 1960s also showed us that Hollywood was capable of adapting to contemporary sounds when it needed to. West Side Story, 1961, had bridged the gap between classical musical theater and something edgier, more relevant to younger audiences. Leonard Bernstein's score incorporated jazz influences and songs like America, as well as Tonight. These songs had a rhythmic vitality that felt more modern than traditional Broadway fare. The soundtrack was a massive commercial success, staying at number one for 54 weeks, an absolutely remarkable achievement that demonstrates how a well-executed musical could still dominate popular culture. After the Beatles, the mid to late 1960s brought an interesting development. Movies trying to capture the youth market by featuring contemporary rock and pop music. Films like The Graduate, 1967, used existing Simon and Garfunkel songs, particularly Mrs. Robinson and The Sound of Silence. This was different from commissioning original songs for a musical. Director Mike Nichols was using popular music to establish mood and character in a dramatic film. Mrs. Robinson became Simon and Garfunkel's second number one hit, and the soundtrack album reached number one on the Billboard 200, staying there for 7 weeks. This approach, using contemporary pop music and non-musical films, would become increasingly important in the 1970s and beyond. But The Graduate demonstrated its commercial viability in the 1960s. The soundtrack didn't need to be written specifically for the film. It just needed to resonate with the audience and enhance the movie's emotional impact. Then you have Easy Rider, 1969, which took this concept even further by creating a compilation album of contemporary rock music from artists like Steppenwolf, The Byrds, and Jimi Hendrix. Born to Be Wild by Steppenwolf became forever associated with the film's images of motorcycles and freedom, and the song reached number 2 on the Billboard Hot 100. This was movie music as cultural curation, selecting existing tracks that captured a specific zeitgeist rather than commissioning new material. The Bond films also deserve mention here because they established a template that continues to this day. The theme song as a marketing tool. Shirley Bassey's Goldfinger, 1964, peaked at number 8 on the Billboard Hot 100 and established the expectation that every Bond film would have a signature song performed by a major artist. This model, pairing a major film franchise with pop music talent, would become increasingly important in subsequent decades. What's fascinating about the 1960s that you can see the old system and the new system operating side by side. Traditional musicals like The Sound of Music were racking up enormous album sales using a production model that dated back to the 1930s, while films like Easy Rider were showing that curated, contemporary music could create equally powerful cultural moments. The decade ended with Hollywood still trying to figure out which approach would dominate the 1970s, but both models had proven commercially visible. And the 1960s demonstrated that movie soundtracks could succeed through multiple approaches: original musical theater compositions, contemporary pop music integration, and strategic curation of existing hits. In conclusion, this diversity of approaches would set the stage for the explosion of soundtrack success in the following decades.
Mr. Mink, before we get to Saturday Night Fever and the explosion of the late 1970s, there is interesting period in the early to mid-1970s where the movie soundtrack are still finding their identity. What were some of the significant soundtrack moments during this traditional period?
The early 1970s are absolutely crucial for understanding what comes later, because this is when you see Hollywood really starting experimenting with different approaches to movie music, and you see both spectacular successes and instructive failures. This is the era when the traditional movie musical was dying. Studios had overinvested in expensive roadshow musicals that bombed. Films like Dr. Dolittle and Star lost fortunes. But at the same time, new models were emerging that would define the blockbuster soundtrack era. One of the most significant developments was the rise of the film composer as an auteur. John Williams emerged during this period with scores for films like The Poseidon Adventure in 1972, then Jaws' 1975 theme, which is one of the most recognizable pieces of film music ever written. Just two notes that create instant tension and dread. The soundtrack album was commercially successful, reaching number 51 on the Billboard 200, which might not sound impressive until you realize it's an instrumental score with no pop songs. Williams proved that purely orchestral film music could still have commercial visibility and viability in an era dominated by rock and pop. But the real innovation of this period was the compilation soundtrack, taking existing hit songs and building them into the film's narrative. American Graffiti, 1973, was revolutionary in this regard. George Lucas built his entire film around period-appropriate rock and roll from the late 1950s and early 1960s, using songs like Rock Around the Clock by Bill Haley and his Comets, Surf and Safari by the Beach Boys, and At the Hop by Danny and the Juniors. The double album soundtrack peaked at number 10 on the Billboard 200 and sold over 7 million copies. What American Graffiti demonstrated was that nostalgia could still be incredibly powerful and commercially viable. Younger audiences discovered or rediscovered these oldies, and older audiences got to relive their youth. This created a blueprint that would be used repeatedly, create a specific era's music, build a film around it, and sell the audience both the movie and the soundtrack as a complete nostalgic package. We see this approach perfected later with films like Dirty Dancing and Forrest Gump. The early 1970s also gave this the main theme of The Godfather, 1972, with Nino Rota's haunting score. It became one of the most recognizable pieces of film music ever composed, and the soundtrack album reached number 5 on the Billboard 200. Again, impressive for an instrumental score. Rota's music was so integral to the film's atmosphere that it's almost impossible to imagine the movie without it. and this demonstrated that orchestral scores could still be powerful commercial and artistic forces. Then you have Superfly, 1972, which represents another crucial development, the soul funk soundtrack. Curtis Mayfield wrote and performed the entire soundtrack, and it became more successful than the film itself. The title track, Superfly, reached number 8 on the Billboard Hot 100, and the soundtrack album spent 4 weeks at number 1 on the Billboard 200. This was significant because it showed that a single artist could create an entire soundtrack that worked both as a film score and a standalone album. Isaac Hayes had done something similar with Shaft, 1971, whose theme song won the Oscar for Best Original Song and reached number 1 on the Billboard Hot 100. These blaxploitation soundtracks, Shaft, Superfly, Trouble Man by Marvin Gaye, proved that there was a significant market for soundtracks that spoke to audiences and that featured contemporary R&B and funk rather than traditional orchestral scores or rock music. This also established that a film's music could have a cultural life that extended far beyond the film's theatrical run. Barbara Streisand's A Star Is Born, 1976, gave us Evergreen, which she co-wrote with Paul Williams. The song won the Oscar for Best Original Song and hit number 1 on the Billboard Hot 100, spending 3 weeks at the top. The soundtrack album reached number 1 on the Billboard 200 and went quadruple platinum. This demonstrated that traditional movie musicals wasn't completely dead. It just needed to be reimagined with contemporary tastes with contemporary stars. One of the most interesting soundtracks from this period is Jesus Christ Superstar, 1973, Andrew Lloyd Webber's and Tim Rice's rock opera brought to film. Songs like I Don't Know How to Love Him became hits, and the soundtrack album was commercially successful. This showed that rock music and traditional musical theater could merge in interesting ways that when handled by talented composers. The Bond franchise continued its tradition of theme songs with efforts like Live and Let Die, 1973, by Paul McCartney and Wings, which reached number 2 on the Billboard Hot 100. These songs functioned as standalone pop hits while also serving the film's marketing needs, a perfect example of corporate synergy before that term became ubiquitous. What's particularly interesting about this period is that there was no single dominant model. You had instrumental scores succeeding commercially, single artists creating entire soundtracks, compilation albums of oldies, rock operas, and traditional movie musicals, all finding audiences and commercial success. Hollywood was experimenting, trying to figure out what would work in a rapidly changing musical landscape where rock had become the dominant popular music form, but there was still room for other approaches. In conclusion, the early to 1970s and the middle part of it laid the ground for what became the blockbuster soundtrack era by establishing multiple viable models. The compilation soundtrack, the single artist soundtrack, the orchestral score as commercial product, and the strategic use of hit songs to market films, all of which would be deployed with increasing sophistication in the years to come.
Mr. Meek, so we have arrived at the moment that changed everything. Saturday Night Fever, what made the soundtrack so revolutionary, and how that transformed the relationship between Hollywood and the music industry?
Saturday Night Fever is genuinely one of those before and after moments in entertainment history. It didn't just break records, it fundamentally restructured how Hollywood thought about soundtracks and how the music industry thought about film as a platform for launching hits. The numbers are almost difficult to comprehend. The soundtrack sold over 40 million copies worldwide, spent 24 weeks at number 1 on the Billboard Hot 200, and spawned 4 number 1 singles on the Billboard Hot 100. To put that in perspective, the album was so dominant that it prevented other albums from reaching number 1 for nearly 6 months. It was a monopoly on popular music. But well, here's what's really important to understand. Saturday Night Fever wasn't conceived as a musical in the traditional sense. The Bee Gees' music wasn't integrated into the narrative like a traditional musical. Characters don't burst into song. Instead, the music exists in the world of the film, playing in the disco where Tony dances, creating this incredible contrast between the euphoria of the music and the bleakness of the story. The Bee Gees reinvented themselves with a falsetto-driven disco sound, and producer Robert Stigwood, who managed both the Bee Gees and was producing the film, saw an opportunity to leverage both properties simultaneously. The band wrote several original songs specifically for the film, including Staying Alive, which reached number one on the Billboard Hot 100 and stayed there for 4 weeks. Night Fever also hit number one, spending 8 weeks at the top. How Deep Is Your Love reached number one and stayed there for 3 weeks. But the soundtrack wasn't just Bee Gees' music. It also featured disco tracks from other artists like Tavares performing More Than a Woman, and Yvonne Elliman singing If I Can't Have You, which also hit number one. What made this revolutionary was the total integration of the film and music marketing machines. The disco boom that Saturday Night Fever helped create meant that for a brief period, disco soundtracks and disco-adjacent music dominated the charts. Films rushed to capitalize on this trend. You had Thank God It's Friday, 1978, whose soundtrack featured Donna Summer's Last Dance, which won the Oscar for Original Best Song and hit number three on the Billboard Hot 100. In this scene, also then came Grease in 1968, which technically wasn't a disco movie, but certainly benefited from the soundtrack-driven mania that Saturday Night Fever had created. Based on the 1971 stage musical, Grease was retrofitted with some new songs and positioned to capture the same audience. The soundtrack sold 28 million copies and spent 12 weeks at number one on the Billboard 200. You're the One That I Want, performed by John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John, spent 1 week at number one on the Billboard Hot 100. Frankie Valli's Grease, the title song, spent 2 weeks at number one. The impact of these two soundtracks on the industry cannot be overstated. Every studio immediately wanted its own Saturday Night Fever or Grease. The period also saw the rise of the soundtrack as a legitimate Grammy category with major prestige. This validated soundtracks as serious musical works, not just commercial products. Saturday Night Fever and Grease transformed movie soundtracks from occasional commercial successes into expected tentpole revenue streams. In conclusion, these soundtracks created cultural moments that generated enormous profits across multiple revenue streams.
Well said, Mr. Mac. Well said indeed, and thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and wisdom to the world. The symphony of the scene of the screen of the world's greatest movie soundtracks and how film score shaped the architecture of human emotion step beyond the visuals and to invisible force that truly move us. Music. For The Haunting of Two Note Tension of the Jaws, or composed by John Williams, to the sweeping emotional landscape. So, Mr. Vink, would you like to plug in something?
Appreciate the opportunity. Write the book, Grow the Business. Connect with me on LinkedIn. GMIC, the Dr. Digital Smith, PhD. Listen to a couple volumes I have on Amazon and pick those up. Burning America and On Track, Ian Hunter. Listen to the Dr. Digital podcast. And if you love music, support true fans.
Indeed, people, I support Mr. Mink, the Dr. Digital, and of course our other podcasts. Sex 101, Love Letters, as well as Mental Health 101, wherever you listen to your podcast. So, Mr. Mike, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, my friend. Until next time, Deus Vult.
Morning, people. See you soon.